episode 3. Welcome to the 99 Podcast, a show dedicated to the LA 99-seat theater community. I'm Benjamin Schwartz.
And I am Matt Ritchie. And today we're going to be talking to two of the artistic directors of the Speakeasy Society, which is an immersive theater company here in Los Angeles. We're going to be speaking with Julianne Just and Matthew Bamberg Johnson. Their company has the Johnny Cycle going on right now. Speaking with Matthew Bamberg Johnson and Julianne Just, who are both the artistic directors of the Speakeasy Society. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you two, did you two both meet at CalArts?
That's correct, yeah. We both met at CalArts. We were in two different programs, but both master's programs. There's also a third artistic director, Genevieve Beerhart, and she was at CalArts as well.
And Jenny and I were both in the MFA acting program, and Julianne was in the MFA directing program.
And Genevieve and I actually, we did experimental theater in New York before coming to California. So we had had a kind of relationship before the Speakeasy Society was born.
Excellent. So and so was it just when the three of you got together that was where the Speakeasy Society really came about? I'm taking a look at your website, and it's got the first project that you guys were working on was about the Lady Macbeth, about the Weird Sisters, the witches. Was that a part of the Speakeasy Society, or was that kind of a early?
That was our first kind of venture into immersive. In my final year of training, I was teaching an institute directing class, and Genevieve took the class. She was in an actor training program, so it was a great chance for her to use her directing skills, which kind of had been put on hold a bit while she was focusing on her acting training. And in that class, the class was just in a regular studio classroom that didn't have a lot to work with, right? You had a rehearsal table, chairs, and there had been a lot of designers in the class, and because they couldn't design the space, I'd really encouraged them to look around campus for different sites they could use for the assignment. And so one of the assignments was to stage the first scene of Macbeth with the witches. And so Genevieve had found this kind of very, very underused and hidden and large women's restroom on campus. And she staged the first scenes of the piece, and it was just really exciting. It was exciting to be in the space and to interact with the space while interacting with the text. And so after class, I approached her and said, this is really exciting. Would you maybe want to think about expanding the piece and working together on it? And because we had been co-directing in New York, she was open to that. And so we filled it out and we created a kind of, it was our version of Macbeth from the witch's perspective. So we used all the witch's scenes and we added in a couple others, but it really focused on their trajectory. And that was kind of the beginning of the company, and we had a chance to bring it from CalArts to LA, a couple months later, and we just found that there was a real market and a real interest for the form, and it was something we were excited to explore, and the longer we've been exploring it, just the more committed we are to it.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you got into the production that way. Was that your first immersive experience? Had you have seen other immersive theater before?
We had all dabbled in, I would say, site-specific or site-responsive work before.
Right.
And had read about things that, would be considered immersive. I think at that point, Julianne, you had seen Sleep No More, too.
Yeah, that was, we I think all of us had seen Sleep No More, and we'd all kind of just gotten back from the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where we had had another immersive experience. So I think it was all kind of on our mind, and we were all very excited by it.
That's exciting.
Also, Matthew and I have an interest in gaming, and, there's some relationship there as well. So it had a lot of potential.
And that kind of brings us to one of the project that we just saw recently, the Johnny Cycle, which I know is kind of the combination of three sections that you've been working on over several years. You have had, I've seen only a handful of your shows because I've only, you know, come into contact with you recently through Matthew. But I love the Kansas cycle that you the Kansas collection that you had, which for those who don't know is kind of a very unique, interesting retelling of The Wizard of Oz. And the company members that you have are amazing. Obviously, I'm seeing primarily the actors, but I'm feeling the direction and the
stage
the
management.
Design and the stage management and all of this stuff. It's so tight, and everyone is so very much on the same page. And we were talking about all of the tracks coming back at the same time and everything being tied together so well. We're wondering a little bit about the company, how many people are kind of consistently involved, and what the process would be that you have if it's the same for every project that you're doing, but and if you can connect that to where the Johnny cycle kind of came out of.
You have like 25 people behind pulling the strings and the ropes, right? I mean,
the core company is currently 7 members, and then we have about 20 to 30 actors that we work with on different projects. Our process, we kind of have 2 different processes that we use pretty frequently depending on work. So something like the Johnny cycle, that came out of a lot of developmental workshops and investigations where we were working with performers. And so in those situations, everyone in the room had read the book. We all had a shared knowledge, and on that day we would set up exercises to start exploring and generate content about whether it was a specific character or theme or scene from the book, or even just an idea of like a form of interaction. Versus the Kansas collection, that was kind of a more of a almost like a writer's room experience where the core company, we gather, we figure out kind of what is the story we're telling for that chapter, what are the important kind of plot points, which characters are involved, what are the beats of interaction. So we've come up with a really detailed outline as a group and then write out the script from there. And then that script, once we brought in the actors, in that case, we were writing for specific actors. So once we had them in the room reading it, we would then, again, adapt the script based on what we weren't hearing it in their voice.
Hmm. Many of the performers have worked with us for the majority of our 7-year history at this point. So it is a bit of a learned language where you understand the concept of I'm present with you and I'm performing, but also in the back of my head, I'm keeping track of what's happening in the other room so I can speed up or slow down this moment of interaction accordingly so that we can arrive for the next scene on time. So it's really a challenge and such a high from a performance standpoint because you are juggling so much and you're so close to the audience member that you really can't fake it either. You have to be there with it.
I felt like everybody across the board was super grounded to their character. You know, ask them, you know, what time they got up in the morning or what they had for lunch. They could have responded immediately, you know, off. And that really, really shows a lot of commitment. So
yeah,
seriously,
we kind of talk about that in the creative process, the idea that not only are you writing a script for an actor on what they need to say in that moment or in that space, in a way, you're kind of crafting an actor's, like a character brain.
So, absolutely.
Again, they know kind of how that character would respond to kind of a variety of things or situations and can really live in it in a more full way. That said, one of the things that is distinct, too, is our work is very scripted. So while, of course, the specific wording sometimes has to shift to, of course, take in the realities of that moment, our work is definitely very much our performers. But in a way, sometimes we overscript, so they have so much material that they can use, but they're not having to make stuff up, but they're also not necessarily going to get to all of it ever. Mm.
And of the two of you, which best could answer, or maybe both, what sort of start was the first thing that came? Was it the story of Dalton Trumbo? Or was it Johnny got his guns? Or whose idea was it to incorporate both sort of a fever dream happening, popping in and out of everything, and sort of comment on just war and everything else that echoes in the themes of the novel and what Trumbo was trying to say. Whose idea was it to kind of make that balance, and which came first?
Well, I read the book when I was in high school, and it was something that just infected my brain and never left me. It is, you know, for those who haven't read it, it's a very short read, actually. It's about 300 pages, but there's so much that's captured in it, and it's written in this kind of feverish style. It feels like Dalton Trumbo with kind of a predecessor to Cormac McCarthy, where, you know, there's not much punctuation. The pace of the book just drives forward, and it kind of doesn't let you go. So when we were kind of kicking a pause in our production, because we did four shows in the first year that we were around as a company, and then we took a moment to breathe and kind of evaluate where we wanted to go next. People were bringing proposals to the table, and I said, "You guys, I've got a great idea. Let's do an immersive show about a character with no arms, legs, eyes, ears, nose, or mouth. It'll be great." And everyone, of course, thought I was crazy.
But that lends itself very much so to the experience that I believe an audience member should have in an immersive theater production, which is no voice. They don't have the option to really, you know, walk around that much. They can explore, but at the same time, you should be controlling that atmosphere and that experience, curating for them on the fly.
Right. Well, that's a design question. Obviously, that's very different. You know, whereas in Speak No More, you know, you aren't speaking at all. You have a lot more physical agency to explore the space. We chose in this piece to have a more curated experience because we wanted to be really targeted about experience. Also, just from a practical standpoint, the mausoleum is so vast and labyrinth-like that it just would not be safe to allow guests to wander on their own. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, I brought the book in and gave it to Julianne to read, and got a phone call the next day saying, you were right, we have to get it. So we, you know, set about the process of workshopping, but there is so much packed into that book. So we were taking a look at, you know, some of the larger overarching themes and figured that we'd do it later in our history when we could find the right kind of targeted space. And then one fell into our lap through a connection that Julianne had. But it wasn't quite. It was the American Legion in Pasadena, which was obviously, this felt very appropriate to begin to tackle the issues that are inherent to the book, but it wasn't quite large enough to encompass the entirety of the piece. So the first piece that we did, which we called Johnny the Quick and the Dead, was mainly about the early life of the main character while he was in Colorado and dealt with a lot of the relationship to family and things of that nature. And then we moved on from there to tackle this idea of war itself in Johnny the Shell, which we did at the St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Glendale, which, Matt, I think you came to for Kansas Collection as well.
Exactly.
You know, that was really interesting, repurposing the church to serve as the battlefield, and the pews became trenches and things of that nature. And that was where we started to introduce the idea of Trumbo and what is his role or his complicity in spreading this message and in creating this character who endured so much suffering in order to get that message across. And we really doubled down on that going into the third installment, where we start introducing the House Un-American Activities Committee hearing and the cost that Trumbo paid in order to you know, stand up for what he believed in. So now that we've come back to the Johnny cycle to encompass all three of those pieces together, we've kind of taken the strongest, most effective moments from that, the 3 years of investigation plus some original content to be something that's a new standalone piece, but does incorporate elements from everything that we've learned along the way.
Because I think there are a couple things that were interesting. Is, you know, when we started on this journey, you know, we read the book and we began workshopping, we didn't know out the gate that the audience was going to be Johnny. That was something really discovered in our process. Mm. Because, you know, at first you start to explore the idea, like, well, what would it mean to have someone in the space who is Johnny, has no arms, no eyes, no legs? How do you represent that? And so that was part of our discovery kind of process, cast learning that we, the most kind of, for our purposes, efficient, like, effective thing to do was to make the audience Johnny. And then also, you know, when you read the novel, there's this intro by Dalton Trumbo, and he never rewrote the book over the years, but he did write new introductions and time passed. And obviously, as a world and a nation, we've had multiple kind of large wars since the book was first written. And it's interesting, the introduction is the space where he can express his shifting thoughts, but he really let the book stay what it was, to really, because he thought that was important. And so I think there was something about these introductions that always kind of it stayed with us as well, and felt like he felt like an important part of that story and his relationship to his book work.
That's great. One of the things that I really loved when I was listening to you talk about how use of the space, not only the use of the space when using the mausoleum, because I was in one of the groups that wanted to be a little bit more physical, and we're doing any spoilers here, but when you were just speaking about using the church as trenches and stuff, one of the things that I love that you guys do is you give this chance for people to play again, and this opportunity to just kind of get out of yourself for a while and go back to this feeling of being a kid and playing and really putting yourself in a certain place and experiencing something if people allow themselves to go over into that. And you guys do a fantastic job of creating those scenarios in a safe way, which I think is fantastic. And one of the things that really works that way is you do a lot of really cool video promos. And we were talking about this fantastic audio that we were listening to on our drive to the mausoleum that really sets up the feeling. You guys are really great at creating a sense of place and a vibe and a feeling of what we're about to go into. Do you have someone who is specifically in charge of that, of your video work? How did you decide to bring that in? What was the process?
We started really engaging video more. You know, we've always kind of done promos and stuff for shows, but we really started engaging additional content as we were doing the Kansas Collection. So the Kansas Collection, as you mentioned, was kind of our take on the Wizard of Oz story, kind of set in a dystopian future after Dorothy leaves. Because it was in these 10 chapters, and these 10 chapters were actually made over a couple of years, we started really putting an investment into creating content that can happen outside of the performance space itself. And that content, while it can add to the experience, it isn't crucial, because the other thing, you can't guarantee that people will engage with that. If they do engage it, you want to make sure that it's growing the experience.
Mm-hmm. But we do have a videographer who comes to document most of the work and all of the promotional material from Johnny Cycle has been filmed by a gentleman named Christopher Dreisbach, and he collaborates with our artistic director, Chris Porter, who is responsible for writing much of the text and music. He was a composition student originally, so those soundscapes are a combination of his work and then the work of the videographer being put together into those little trailers and promos.
And then the longer podcast that we send out before the Johnny Cycle, that came out of kind of multiple interests. One is we initially developed it for when we did the Johnny Cycle, The Living, and the idea was it was a way to fill people in on kind of some of the earlier from The Quick and the Dead and The Shell. Now this year we're looking at it as a culminative piece, but we really loved how the podcasts work. Obviously, the mausoleum's in Altadena, so it's a bit of a drive for most people to go there, and we loved the idea that the experience starts before you arrive in the space. And kind of getting people in the zone of the piece and in the mood of the piece on that drive over. Also, you know, driving in LA is kind of, well, it can be a very frustrating experience. It can also be like real moments of beauty, and I think podcast in a way kind of plays into that as well. You know, there's something operatic about the freeways here, so it kind of adds to that.
It's fantastic. One of the things that we like to do here is we're going to do a quick a roundup for you individually, speed round of questions. But before we get to that, I want to mention that the Johnny Cycle tickets are available right now on SpeakeasySociety.com. And how long is the show running?
We're running through September 21st, so we'll be closing on Saturday the 21st.
Okay, fantastic. And do you have something? You have another show playing right now or coming up?
We have a show that that actually is on a brief hiatus for the moment, but we collaborated with Two Bit Circus to create another episodic series called Under the Big Top. And the first installment of that, Under the Big Top Atlas, as I mentioned, just went on hiatus, but we are looking at the possibility of bringing that back up for future dates. And you can find information about that also on our website, and I believe also on the Two Bit Circus website at this point, too.
All right, so we're going to do a little quick speed round. I'm going to ask a series of questions. Julianne, if you could answer first, and then Matthew, you can answer second. So knowing what you know now, what advice would you give yourself when first getting into theater?
Oh, that it's a long game, and that you're just going to have to be patient and to really just enjoy where you are in your process. And while you're always going to be pushing forward and wanting to take the work further, to acknowledge and appreciate kind of the successes and growth along the way.
Excellent. Mr. Bamberg Johnson.
I would say sort of a two-parter. One is find your tribe. You know, make work with the people who excite you and who challenge you and who enable you to do things that you can't do on your own. And the other is that, you know, failure is an opportunity. Setbacks are opportunities for learning, and that it just enables you to grow and to alter course for your next adventure.
And let's see, starting with Julianne, what's something that comes up in your work that you feel like people might not notice?
Yeah, I can jump in on that. So I think that we're mentioning how it felt like it was seamless and the timing of all the individual elements coming together. And I think that's a piece of the work that people don't necessarily see or think about is, you know, the scene work is one thing, right? You create the beautiful writing and rehearse the scene and you get it up and going. But then when you put all the pieces together, you have to make adjustments, you have to trim things or add things, invert order so that it can all fit together in a way that makes sense to the guest experience. So that's an element of the work that remains unseen, but it's crucial to what we do.
And I guess I would say, you know, regardless of the work, whether it's, you know, us exploring The Wizard of Oz or, you know, this seminal novel of Dalton Trumbo's, I do think we really, though, all of our characters, all of the stories we're telling, it's deep personal journeys that everyone is going on, all of our characters, and hopefully our audience living in that world. It really is a look within into the choices you're making and kind of, you know, I don't want to say dark night of the soul, but I do think there's a lot of personal interrogation and investigation. And I think, you know, one of the things that, we work as a company. Our work is super collaborative. There's a lot of voices helping to build and shape the piece. But, you know, I think all of us have kind of moments of our own personal investigations and struggles and kind of interrogations of life sewn into all these pieces as well. So I think it's kind of the accepting, deeply personal element that's in there.
Connected to that, what either place or thing connected to Los Angeles specifically really inspires you?
I guess I would say the vastness of the city. It's a huge city, and I've almost been here for 10 years now, and I feel like I know just a fraction of it. So there's something about the city that I think encourages and invites kind of venturing into the unknown, trying something new. And I think it kind of shapes the people who live in L.A. I feel like that was part of why L.A. felt like a great home for, like, creating an immersive theater company. There's something about audiences here that I feel like people are hungry to be kind of pushed outside their normal path. You know, we all have kind of our routines. We drive to work. We go to the same coffee shops. And so experiences that take us somewhere new and outside kind of the steps and basic interactions we're having day to day.
I was going to give a very similar answer, but I'll put a slightly different spin on it. I grew up in mostly rural settings. I was born in Vermont. I was raised in southern Indiana. I lived all over secluded areas of New England before coming out to California. And I've never really thought of myself as a city person, but one of the things about LA that really inspires me and works for me is it feels like it's a series of interconnected neighborhoods. And whenever anyone tells me that they don't like LA, I ask them, but where did you go and who did you go with? Because similar to Julianne, like, I'll never run out of things to learn or new experiences to have as long as I'm here and as long as I allow myself to be open to those experiences. So I hope that our work also encourages that sense of discovery and openness in our guests.
I absolutely love that, because one reason why we're doing that, this whole podcast, is because we love Los Angeles theater. We love Los Angeles specifically so much. And same thing. I feel like I could explore this city and each day and find something new, and there'll be more new things opening up too. And speaking specifically, we love 99-seat theater in Los Angeles. And I don't know if you're like me, but I feel like there's could be some improvements that could be had. Is there anything that you feel that could improve 99-seat theater and just Los Angeles theater in general, or something that you'd like to see changed?
Well, it's kind of funny because, you know, seats are very loosely engaged in our work, particularly in the Shiny Cycle. So our capacity is small, and that intimacy, I think, is really key to our work, is creating that sense of connection between performer and guest. And I do think that, you know, immersive is in an interesting place where part of the reason we're so excited to talk to you is that it is not often recognized, I think, by the traditional Los Angeles theater scene. That might not be the direction you were thinking I would go with that question, but I would like to see more cross-pollination between traditional 99-seat theater houses and groups like ours, where there's an opportunity for us to see one another's work and to be, you know, considered under similar reviewing criteria or eligible for awards, things of that nature. That's the challenge that we experience a bit.
I totally agree, and I guess bouncing off from that question a little bit more, specifically, is there a, for Julianne, is there a, have a cultural shift happen in the way that audiences perceive smaller theater experiences in Los Angeles?
On some level, it's very much what Matthew is saying. I think, immersive theater, what I think is so great about it, I think it's weird to even call it immersive theater. I think we just have now started immersive, one word. But what's great is, I mean, on one level, it is very much rooted in theater. It is a theatrical experience, and it's really coming out of a theatrical practice, just happening in a different space and with different boundaries in terms of kind of like where that space between performer and audience begins and ends. But it is rooted in that experience. And on the other side, I think it appeals to so much much, you know, unfortunately, you know, sometimes live theater gets a bad rap and people are like, oh, I don't want to go see a play. And it's like, so in some way, immersive is perfect, both for those who want to go see a theatrical show and those who don't. It serves both of those purposes. But again, you know, I think so much of immersive is about, it is about that intimate relationship between performer and audience. And that can happen outside of a traditional theatrical space. And it can also happen within, you know, I was lucky enough to get to see part of Taylor Mack's 24-hour musical history when it was here. And, you know, I in that experience, it was a really exciting experience for me because, you know, you walk in and you sit in a chair in what is essentially a large theatrical space, and yet I had what turned out to be a very immersive experience. And so that was a really kind of exciting dialogue I had to have with myself about, like, is this immersive? Is it immersive in the same way we're immersive? What, again, going back to this kind of, like, massive question that continually we are having conversations around about, like, what is immersive in general? But I do think at its core there is something, it's about this active relationship happening in the space.
Here, because it's kind of been burning inside me. We've been trying to figure out, we have a lot of discussions on this. How do you define immersive theater, or what are the rules behind it, if there are any?
Yeah. I mean, and that can be different for different companies and different productions. And I think the core thing that we try to come back to is the essential nature of the audience's presence, that you have to be there in order for the work, for the event to function. And I think that's one thing that differentiates us from proscenium shows, which could theoretically perform to an empty house. You see through the action of the Johnny cycle that those things couldn't happen if you weren't there. That the characters are engaging you, your presence is necessary in order for the action to occur.
Which, I mean, that even goes just so deeply into our rehearsal process. We have certain scenes within the piece that literally we have to have audience in the room to rehearse it, because they are that actively woven into the action of the moment.
Thank you, guys. We really, really appreciate it. We've been speaking with Julianne Just and Matthew Bamberg-Johnson, co-artistic directors of the Speakeasy Society, who currently have the Johnny Cycle running at the Mausoleum. You can check it out at speakeasysociety.com. Go get tickets. It's super fun. Thank you so much for being with us, you guys. You're our first interview, and we really appreciate having you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been an interview with Matthew Bamberg-Johnson and Julianne Just, co-artistic directors of the Speakeasy Society, a Los Angeles-based immersive theater company.
They've got the Johnny Cycle going on right now up at the Mausoleum, so make sure to log on to their website and grab some tickets straight through September. And we will see you next time on the 99.